UnionAmericans.org. Thanks.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you this March 6, 2011 on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking about media, as usual, on a show called Media Matters, and we're going to be talking specifically about media justice and the Center for Media Justice. Our guest today will be the founder of that organization, one of the leaders of the movement. It's going to be a great pleasure to have her with us, Malkia Cyril. But before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
For the fourth time in 4 years, Time Warner Cable is pushing a bill in North Carolina to stamp out competition from municipal broadband systems that hurt its profits by serving the public at a reasonable price. Representative Marilyn Avila, a Republican from Wake County, introduced the bill, which throws a series of restrictions and obstructions targeted only at publicly funded broadband services, leaving for-profit providers like Time Warner free from local regulation. Catherine Rice, president of CTOA, the Southeast Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, was there when the Public Utilities Committee passed the bill.
It was kind of symbolic when Representative Avila walked in the room and the first group she went to was Time Warner's lobbyists, where she had a nice long talk, and one of their top lobbyists actually rubbed her back as she was walking away, which to me was like, okay.
Rice says the hearing had the earmarks of a kangaroo court.
Some of the committee members saw through what the game was going to be and asked questions and tried to create at least a more reasonable discussion, but that got just kind of closed off quickly, and then the vote ramrodded through.
Avila and the finance chair, Juliet Howard, promised that they would work to protect the state's two operating fiber systems. But Rice says the legislators seem to be favoring the corporate side of the debate. Avila showed her allegiance at a meeting last week with the cable providers and city leaders.
Halfway through the meeting, she handed the discussion directly to Time Warner Cable's lobbyist, deferring to him as the communication expert and asking him to carry on the meeting and the discussion. So I don't have a lot of faith. Things are actually going to go real well in those promises.
Even if the bill ends up protecting current muni broadband networks, Rice says the legislation would burn the rest of North Carolina.
These companies have already made it clear that our rural areas, because our homes are so far apart and our incomes are low, they're not going to serve them. They're not serving them. And instead of the committee talking about that and ways of improving the broadband, they are trying to crush a few cities that are doing fiber to the home. So it's a sad moment for North Carolina.
For more information, go to CETOA.org. That's CETOA.org.
For decades now, the audience for TV news has been shrinking. And as viewers tune out, news directors around the country push for more sensational coverage. Unfortunately for them, if it bleeds, it leads reporting usually turns off even more viewers, creating a vicious cycle of more salacious coverage and more viewers changing the channel. Worse than that, that style of reporting doesn't do anything to address the problems that lead to violence or heal the communities that violence harms. To fill that gap, the local public access station in Philadelphia, called PhillyCam, is producing a program called Unsolved Philadelphia. Beth McConnell of the nonprofit advocacy group Media and Democracy Coalition says the show is a testament to why public access stations are so vital.
Being made by a couple of local producers that saw so many murders in their neighborhoods and the communities where they grew up, and so many of these murders remain unsolved and the family continue to struggle and mourn the loss of their loved ones. So they decided, well, hey, is there something that we can do to both educate people here in the community and encourage people who know something to speak up, but also really keep the attention and the pressure on the police to find the perpetrator, and then also really provide a voice to the family so that they have an outlet to share their grief.
In fact, community stations like PhillyCam are stepping up to fill a lot of gaps in the journalism world today. But public educational and government access, or PEG stations, are facing increasing funding threats. PEG stations are traditionally funded by cable companies in exchange for exclusive rights to customers in a community. But recent legislation has stripped some cities of the right to impose those conditions. And there are more of these bills on the horizon.
As a result, in a number of states around the country, we've seen these stations shut down and close their doors, and others operating at bare bones with very, very minimal resources.
McConnell says PEG stations let people create programming that's relevant to their communities, and they should be protected. She said people need to let state and federal officials know that PEG stations are important to them. Check out McConnell's organization at media-democracy.net. Find out if your community has a PEG station at ourchannels.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. Today we're going to be talking about media as usual, but not just media in the way we always talk about or usually talk about, but instead we're going to be talking about the movement for media justice. And we're very fortunate to have as our guest today the executive director and founder of the Center for Media Justice on the line with us from Oakland, California. Malkia Cyril is with us. And Malkia, thank you very much for joining us today. Malkia. Okay. I think we're still working on our connection here to get Malkia. And let me see if I'm getting some notification here. We're working on getting Malkia linked up here. In the meantime, while we're getting Malkia back on the line with us from Oakland, just want to thank all the listeners for the good words that we've received in the last week or two about last week's program on the fate of public broadcasting and the support it gets at the federal level. That is very much up for grabs now. And there's so much going on in the world today, and there's so much going on in the nation today in terms of enormous political stories, including obviously Libya and Egypt and the entire Middle East, including Wisconsin and the Indiana and Ohio. I think I hear Malkia there. Are you there, Malkia? I hear her, but unfortunately she apparently does not hear me. And I'm not sure how that is, so I'm waiting to hear
Hello?
From... Hello, Malkia. Are you there? Malkia? I apologize again to listeners for this. Apparently, she does not hear me for reasons that make no sense. And we're going to keep trying until we do get through to her. And I think my producer and engineers are working on this right now. Probably going to have to redial her and make a new connection, but I'll wait to get instructions from them. But as I was saying, in the meantime, while we're working on getting Malkia on the line with us, there's so much going on in the world today with Libya and Egypt, with what's taking place in Wisconsin and Indiana and Ohio with, you know, these really unprecedented for generations uprisings of union workers, of people across the political spectrum and the social spectrum to oppose the effort to break up the right for legal collective bargaining. And with, the other great issue, which is whether the federal government will even have a budget and be open, that the battle over public and community radio and broadcasting has sort of slipped through the cracks and is getting very little attention. But people close to the situation believe that we're in a situation right now where it is more threatened than ever before in the history of the country. And many of our listeners no doubt remember the attack on community and public broadcasting in the mid-1990s following the 1994 off-year election. And that got a lot of attention. And that was not anywhere near, in retrospect, as serious an attack as this one is. And some of you may be inclined to want to zero out the public funding for stations like WILL or for community stations. And if you are, that's certainly your privilege. Some of you might not feel that way. But at any rate, whatever your position, it's imperative that your voice be heard by members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, so that there be public participation on something as fundamental as the existence of stations like this. And we're going to keep trying to go back, and I'm going to try again. Hello, Malkia Cyril. Are you there, Malkia? And again, I regret, I hear her in the background, but I fear she does not hear me for reasons that are unclear to my technologically unsavvy mind. So I think our team is hard at work on this process right now. This is really an unprecedented situation where I can't hear the guest. If she can't hear me, I can hear her. Maybe I'll have to email her questions or something, but that sort of makes for a bizarre show. And she's waiting to hear from me, but apparently she cannot hear me at all. So she's just sitting there not knowing what's going on, as far as anyone can tell. So this is Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, the host. It is a live program coming to you today, March 6, 2011. And for reasons that are not exactly clear, we're waiting to get our connection with our guest, Malkia Cyril from the Center for Media Justice. And while we're waiting for Malkia, let me tell you a little bit about the Center for Media Justice. It's based in Oakland, California. It has people in New York and also in Chicago. It is a movement that looks explicitly to connect battles for media reform and to change media and media criticism specifically with campaigns for economic, social, and racial justice. It's self-identified as a very much a progressive movement. And it is very much a progressive movement. And it's been one of the dramatic breakthroughs in media activism.
Hello?
Malkia, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am. Hi, how are you?
Well, it's great to hear your voice finally. I'm sorry for the mix-up.
No problem.
But we're with you, and that's great. And I was just trying to give my own definition, Malkia Cyril, of what media justice is. And I think you could probably do a better job of that than I could. So please, what is media justice for listeners who may not be familiar with the term at all?
Right. It's a highly contested term. I mean, it's a framework and a vision for media change that takes critical short-term media reforms and kind of gives them a long-term vision. It centers grassroots leadership, local organizing, regional to national collaboration, and seeks to create the kind of media rules and rights that advance racial, economic justice, and human rights. It really seeks to move beyond a media system that is corporate-controlled and that is kind of regulated also through that corporate lens. We want popular governance over our media system. We want to make sure that every person who's participating in a democracy also has the opportunity to participate in their media, in media making, media production. We want to shift the terms of production. We want to make sure that regular people, everyday people, get to have a voice in what's being said, read, listened to over their media system. So that's really what media justice is. It's a vision, it's a framework, and it's a practice. It's a way of organizing for media change that involves everybody.
So if I get you right, Malkia Cyril, media justice isn't just fighting on media issues, but it's fighting on broader social issues and injecting the media side of the equation in those struggles?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you look at a question, when you look at education, when you look at housing, when we look at questions of health care, inherent in all of those things is, one, how are we communicating about those issues? What kind of media system gives us the information we need to make the kind of policy changes that are necessary to fulfill the dreams of every American? That's the kind of media movement we're trying to build, a media movement that is deeply connected to the basic issues of our lives and that isn't kind of focused on the media. The question is not what kind of change do we need in the media, what kind of media do we need to make social change?
Malkia Cyril, you are the founder and executive director of the Center for Media Justice, based in Oakland, California. What does the center do? How big is it? What are the issues you guys are working on? Tell our listeners a little bit about the center.
It's a great question. At the Center for Media Justice, we are about a 10-person shop. We do two things. One, on one side, we help organizations build the kind of communication strategies they need to make the kind of change they want. On the other side, we help organizations and individuals build the media justice movement so that we can change media policies, media regulations, and improve the kind of media rights we have that protect all of us. So we work on media reform and media policy change, and we work on communication strategies, both toward a vision of a healthy, vibrant society that allows each of us to grow and fulfill our dreams.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Malkia Cyril, the executive director of the Center for Media Justice out of Oakland, California, who's been an organizer for probably longer than either of us care to remember, 15 years it looks like, and has won numerous awards. Her work and articles have been published, interviews have been published in leading major media, including the San Francisco Weekly, the New York Times, the Village Voice, on and on. It's an honor to have her as our guest today. If people would like to call in with a question or comment for Malkia Cyril, the phone number here at Media Matters is 217-333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Malkia, it strikes me that, you know, following this from where I sit, you have been very active, and the Center for Media Justice has been very active on the battle for network neutrality in the internet, and to sort of eliminate the sort of digital divide, to use an old term, but one that allows for discrimination on class and racial grounds online. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the work you guys at the Center for Media Justice do on the internet and the whole issue of network neutrality and how that's playing out?
Absolutely. Well, right now, you know, for the last 10 years, what we've really seen, and possibly a little longer than that, is a transition of most of our communications infrastructure to digital platforms. What that means is that whatever inequity existed before, you know, in terms of, you know, who had access to cable and who didn't, you know, the access that people had to radio, whatever inequities existed before are now being kind of digitized, right? We're digitizing inequity. And so what I want to say about that is that the internet, you know, is one of the most vibrant, decentralized media systems of our time. We have an opportunity with the internet to close some of those gaps, close some of the gaps that existed before, not only in media, but also we have an opportunity to use the internet to close some of the gaps in healthcare access, close some of the gaps in education access. This divide that you mentioned is real. You know, a report came out last week that basically verified what poor people and people of color around this country already knew, that some people, a very, very small amount of people enjoy full access, while a large amount of people enjoy partial or very limited or no access at all. This kind of divide in access is just the beginning, though. We understand that without access to the internet, we can't apply for jobs, we can't advance our education, we can't achieve the kind of economic opportunity we seek. But at the same time, even when we have access, our rights are limited. Network neutrality is one of those rights, is a place where we can actually secure some rights. It's a set of rules, real basic rules, that allow for free speech online. It's the internet's Bill of Rights. And unfortunately, you know, several weeks ago, the Republican House decided to block funding to the FCC to prevent them from having the authority to move those rules forward and to implement those rules. The rules are basic. They are very basic. They're very minimal. In fact, we want better rules. We want rules that protect people even better than the ones that exist now. But the ones that are there now will allow us to do the work we need to do to close that digital divide. Without them, it's very hard. Without them, our internet infrastructure is going to be left on the open market. And in my mind, if you leave the internet to the open market, that's like leaving a bleeding child in open water with sharks. You know, companies are going to come in. It's a feeding frenzy. There's a lot of money to be made. And regular people like myself and the people that I work with are left out in the cold. So that's why the Center for Media Justice has been so vigilant in ensuring that net neutrality is protected, ensuring that these rules that mean that all content, all websites, you know, all speech online is treated the same without discrimination. We think that is a basic civil rights principle. We don't even understand why anyone would be against that, except if there was money to be made by not having those rules in place.
Melchior Cyril, the money to be made in a world where you do not have network neutrality, where the broadband internet service providers, and this means three or four companies in effect,
yes.
Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T are the big three, and they usually operate monopolies or duopolies, so they have immense market power. In a world without network neutrality, where they can discriminate against websites and discriminate against services, so they can basically turn the internet into cable TV, it's clear they're going to make a lot of money, and it's understandable that this is mission critical to them to be able to effectively privatize the internet.
Yeah.
And one of the things you see, I think, that it's almost impossible for people to understand who aren't behind the scenes or actively involved in this work, is just how much money and just how much thinking AT&T and Verizon and Comcast spend and how much work they do to try to undermine opposition to support for network neutrality and to sort of make it possible for them to effectively privatize the internet. Can you talk a little bit about what sort of stuff AT&T and that crowd is up to?
Well, I can say a couple of things. First of all, let's talk about cell phones for a minute. These big companies have already articulated that quote-unquote ethnic consumers are the major buying power in the telecom market. Cell phone ownership is higher among African Americans and Latinos than among whites, and people of color who own cell phones take advantage of a much greater range of their phone's features compared with white mobile users, right? So what we know is that by 2009, one out of every $3 spent on telecommunication services came from quote-unquote U.S. ethnic communities. So what we're looking at a community that's like a cash cow to mobile providers. So when recently MetroPCS, using the FCC's, under the FCC's new rules, decided to and let me go back. Let me just say that MetroPCS in communities of color is often called GetroPCS.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the phone that you can get. You know, it's the phone that you can definitely get, whereas most of the other phones are out of reach, out of range.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the GetroPCS phone, the MetroPCS phone, decided to offer a tiered service, right, which is their right under the new net neutrality rules. Net neutrality rules, as of now, do not give wireless users the same protection as they give users of fixed broadband. So I don't have the same protection on my phone as I have at home enjoying my laptop. It's a problem. And what ended up happening is MetroPCS decided that they were going to offer what they called unlimited internet service, but actually that unlimited service only gave you access to a few websites,
mm-hmm.
like Facebook, YouTube, and other kind of entertainment-based websites. So when you put all that together, you say, okay, this is a community. Poor people, communities of color, actually spend more on cell phone usage than other communities and get less. So, you know, this juxtaposition is a clear indicator of what's to come. This is what the future of mobile technologies looks like, a tiered discriminatory system that disenfranchises the poorest among us.
And there's a scandal surrounding MetroPCS, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's the basic thing is that they offered the service, and then they were challenged, you know, by our friends at Free Press and other places, saying that they were, by offering this quote-unquote unlimited service, calling it unlimited, but only actually offering a few access to a few websites, they effectively, I mean, I won't, you know, to me, that's called fraud. Now, legally, I don't know about what that would be considered, but to me, that's false advertising, and it's an attempt to gain consumer dollars without giving consumers what you actually say you're offering. So that is something that, you know, we're really drawing attention to because we think it's the first among many. Many situations exactly like this that are going to emerge over time. And, you know, the funny thing is that many people thought when we talked to a lot of social justice groups and a lot of community organizations about why net neutrality is so important, many of those groups initially were like, I don't understand, it's too technical, it doesn't make sense. Once Metro PCS, committed this act of offering something that it really wasn't offering, these organizations jumped on it. They were infuriated. Thousands of people around the country raised their voices to say, wait a minute, this is not the internet service that we deserve. We deserve better. Just because we're poor, just because we're low income, doesn't mean that we deserve to be discriminated against. And I think we're going to see more of that as time goes on.
Our guest is Malkia Searle, who you've just been listening to, the executive director for the Center for Media Justice based in Oakland, California. We're going live today in WILL AM 580, so if you'd like to call in, the phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or our toll-free line 1-800-222-9455. Malkia Searle, you just hit on an issue in discussing net neutrality, which I think is very important. As I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, the FCC's net neutrality rules, which it passed, they're quite controversial rules that were passed in December,
yeah.
They provided fairly adequate, at least near-term, net neutrality protection for the traditional broadband line into your home computer, or your office computer, meaning
right.
that those companies can't take websites down if they don't pay them a toll. But there are limitations for down the road. But the real problem was they didn't do anything to protect the sort of cell phone wireless world, which is those companies, which are primarily what Verizon and AT&T, do not have to honor net neutrality. So they have the right to do the sort of stuff Metro PCS is doing, which is cherry pick which websites they want you to go to and not let you go to other ones. To me, that's not very impressive net neutrality, because it seems that as the world goes increasingly wireless, and we see this all over. I mean, it's just one of the great trends of our time is that people are doing more and more with their handheld personal computers.
Yeah.
That if that world is going to be not covered by net neutrality, if the phone companies, the Verizons and AT&Ts, don't have to like honor net neutrality there, it's just going to be a short period of time until Comcast and the cable companies say, hey, this isn't fair. Those guys don't have to honor net neutrality. Well, how come we have to?
I think that's an extremely important point. I mean, we worked hard and long with the FCC, along with our various partners in and outside of the Beltway, to ensure that there were some rules of the road, right? We believe that there have to be some rules of the road, that the Internet can't be left on the open market. Unfortunately, the rules of the road we got discriminated against wireless users. What we want is some broadband parity here. We want to make sure that wireless users and users of fixed broadband are treated the same. Basic equal representation under the rules. That's what we want. And I think it's a pretty standard civil rights principle. It's not confusing. And what is confusing is why, when you have nearly two-thirds of African Americans, that's 64%, and 63% of Latinos as wireless users, when you have 87% of blacks and Latinos owning cell phones compared with 80% of whites, when you have 18% of blacks and 16% of English-speaking Latinos only have access to the Internet through their cell phones, compared with 10% of whites, it's actually in total more than half of African-Americans and Latinos go online from a mobile phone only. So when you have those types of numbers screaming at you, saying that there is, the poorest among us, the communities of color, the groups that are already disenfranchised in this nation, that they have such a limited access to the Internet, and there's only one door through which they enter, why aren't we doing everything we can to keep that door wide open? That's what's confusing to me.
Our guest, Malkia Searle, the phone number again, 217-333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Let's go to our first caller right now to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Malkia Searle.
Good afternoon. Yeah, I have a specific question. I heard some reporting about the broadband initiative, but I wanted to preface it or have a comment too, which is this seems to come up all the time through our political history, and this is the idea of the right to communicate. in the Reagan era, there was an attack on UNESCO that was premised on the idea that they were espousing not necessarily a limit on corporate speech, but communication techniques, but some kind of commitment to a right for individuals and communities to communicate. It was under the aegis of UNESCO, One World, Many Voices. I can't help but take a shot at the idiocy of Hillary Clinton giving this talk about the right to communicate and communicate around the world, and whilst someone who is making a nonviolent statement against her policies is manhandled and bruised and ejected from the arena. But the specific question is, I heard some reporting that said that the Obama administration was sort of taking some criticisms on their face that the broadband initiative was actually bringing more broadband to suburban areas than where it was supposedly targeted at. It seems to me that these are the places where this kind of affirmative action isn't necessary, and it's also quite typical that the political process would serve the people that don't need to be served. Is that a fair assessment of what's happened with the broadband initiative? And that's not a reason to accept any defunding of it. It seems to me it just means that it ought to be run a little better. So I'd like for you to comment on that specific. I don't know if you need to say anything about the preface. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Malkia Cyril?
Thanks. You know, I can't speak specifically to whether the Obama's broadband initiative is going to bring more broadband to places that already have it. What I can say is that currently the focus on transforming the Universal Service Fund into Connect America has a disproportionate focus on expanding the resources for the high cost fund, which is money that goes directly to telecommunications companies to subsidize their build out in rural communities and other communities as well. There are other parts of the fund that do that too. The point is that the low income subsidies and the E-rate are kind of, in my opinion, being ignored. And low income subsidies, you know, support connections and access in low-income households. So I think with this kind of disproportionate focus on the high-cost fund, what you're seeing is a disproportionate focus on build-out. And build-out has very little to do. I mean, basically what we're talking about is giving access, basic access. And it ignores, I think, a couple of things. One is what happens after access is achieved, basic access is achieved. Does that mean that those communities have any capacity to use the Internet that they now have access to? Does it mean that the content of that Internet is free and open and that they have the opportunity to use it to fulfill their dreams? No, it doesn't. So the disproportionate focus on build-out, the disproportionate resources to telecommunications companies to subsidize that build-out, on top of the public subsidies that have already been given to telecommunications companies over the last 40 years to subsidize the existing build-out, I think represents a neglect of the dreams and the needs of everyday Americans. And that, I think, is a problem of the current broadband initiative and something that needs to be addressed.
Malkia Cyril, the Obama administration has now been in office for 2.5 years or coming up in that area. And we've had the Obama administration's FCC with three Democrats having a majority now during most of that period. And with its current chair, Julius Genachowski, President Obama's, you know, close friend and confidant running the FCC as its chair. On issues of broadband and network neutrality and Internet in general, what grade would you give the Obama administration?
Well, that's a great question. If I'm being totally honest, I give the Obama administration right now a B. And I give them a B because they have passed. They have set some rules of the road. They have, battled around this question of net neutrality. Obama has articulated a commitment to a free and open internet. He has a broadband expansion package. However, you know, as I said, the disproportionate focus on build-out, on additional public subsidies being used to privatize the internet, that is an oxymoron, in my opinion. The fact that more and more public subsidies are going to increasingly privatized internet, that's confusing to me. Public subsidies should be used to ensure the internet remains a public entity, not the other way around. So on that, I give him a B. I give Obama's administration and FCC a B in that we have this incredible leader in the newest commissioner, Commissioner Clyburn, Mignon Clyburn. She has demonstrated an enormous effectiveness and commitment and integrity in the decisions that she's made and the way that she's tried to battle. Of course, Commissioner Copps has continued his long-standing commitment to the public interest, and even together, their two kind of brave march, the brave march forward of these two individuals was insufficient to really move FCC Chairman Jenikowski, who, you know, has a difficult job of balancing, you know, private interests and public interests, but his job is to manage the public interest. That is his mandate. And obviously, addressing the needs and considerations of private industry is part of that mandate, but the mandate is to preserve the public interest. And in the new FCC rules, I feel that the FCC failed to do that. So Obama's FCC gets a B. Obama himself, President Obama, also gets a B in that there is too much influence of private industry and private corporations in the public decision-making process around what is best for this nation. I think that the decision to discriminate against wireless users, the decision to not protect all users from paid prioritization, these decisions, they represent a serious influence, overwhelming influence of private industry on the decisions of public sector representatives. And I think that's the problem. What I think is great, however, is the passage of the Local Community Radio Act, in Congress. I think that was a wonderful and needed step. So there are some victories and some shining examples of what could be. Unfortunately, that did not come out of the FCC. That came out of a different entity. So the FCC and Obama's FCC has some growth, I think, it needs to achieve. Obama's administration has some hard look that it needs to take at its priorities.
Melchisio, do you think that you just mentioned the Local Community Radio Act, which, as I understand it, will make it possible for hundreds, many hundreds, maybe even 1,000 new low-power FM radio stations to fill in the gaps in the FM dial all across the country and go into nonprofit and non-commercial groups? But, you know, one of the arguments I often hear, and I'd like to hear your response to it, is that with Twitter and Facebook and the web and all the stuff going on, electronically and with wireless communication, this sort of issues of media ownership, the big deals like Comcast and NBC merging, for example, these no longer really matter because people don't really depend on old media anymore. And this applies, this argument, even more so to communities of color, that they're sort of leapfrogging over their lousy media system, going directly to create their own world on Facebook and with Twitter. How do you respond to that?
I think it's an interesting conundrum. I think that, one, it isn't true that people don't read the newspaper. They do. They may read it online, but they do read the newspaper. I think journalism, I think there's a couple of answers to your question. I think, one, journalists and journalism still has a role to play in preserving democracy, an incredibly important role to play. I think believing that somehow we can leapfrog over journalism to kind of opinion and analysis of individuals is wrong, actually. I think we need professional journalists to give us the news and information that we need to make decisions about the policies that exist in our society and the rules. So that's one. too, I think that, you know, for communities of color, the internet is a vast opportunity. It's a well of opportunity to bypass the barriers that exist in our old media system, traditional media system in this country, and be able to create. However, these mergers, the NBC Comcast merger, and the fact that the internet, while you may enjoy various types of access to the internet, you actually have very little control over the rules right now. You know, and the rules determine whether or not you can continue to enjoy that decentralized, open, you know, access, or if it will become increasingly difficult to access your favorite website, to create your own website, whether or not it will become increasingly expensive. All the barriers that existed in traditional media could exist on the internet if we don't protect it.
Melchior Cyril, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Phone lines open at 217-333-9455. Or you can go to 1-800-222-9455, our toll-free number, if you want to talk to Melchior Cyril, who's the executive director for the Center for Media Justice based in Oakland, California. And full disclosure, the group I helped start, Free Press, has worked closely with Melchior Cyril and her organization since our beginning, roughly the same time. So we're both approaching our first decade in this battle. Melchior, if I can just change direction for a second here, something I want to ask you about, which isn't anything you might have nothing to say on this, but I'm very interested to hear your response. You know, we've in the Midwest here, we've had a series of labor uprisings in Wisconsin and to a lesser extent Indiana and Ohio that have really, especially in Wisconsin, are unprecedented for generations in the United States. I mean, you have to literally go back 50, 60, 70 years to see anything like this.
That's right.
And I was just wondering what your take is on it, because I know that you're not just, you know, I don't want to typecast you as just someone who's out there doing digital policy. I mean, I know you're thinking always about politics and justice. What's your take on this movement, this moment, and is there a media way, do you see media connections here?
Well, absolutely. I mean, okay, let me start from the beginning of my thought. I think about this a lot. First of all, I want to say that I am extremely inspired and awestruck by the dedication and the commitment of the labor movement and workers in Wisconsin right now, and of the representatives that have taken the risks that they've taken to protect labor rights in Wisconsin. So let me start with that. Labor rights are for everybody. They're for media workers as well. I think that one of the problems that has emerged in this fight around the internet and around all of our entire media system is that the rights of workers in that system have been ignored. And that's why, you know, some of the biggest media unions are, they side with companies sometimes. And I think that, you know, as a media movement start thinking about, you know, how do we, which is, I think, the big question for everyone, how do we protect our democracy, our jobs, our basic right to live from big companies whose bottom line is the bottom line? How do we do that? What kind of rules and laws do we need in order to make that protection real? We need the kind of determination that we see in Wisconsin. So I want to start there, that workers' rights are media rights. Media rights are workers' rights. We need to begin making those connections, in part because, as you can see, as the drama has unfolded in Wisconsin, the story of Wisconsin will determine whether or not there's popular support for what's going on there. It will determine in large measure, how successful that battle is, right? Whether or not the story is told well, whether or not the story can reach the right people, all of that depends upon having a healthy, democratic, and open media system that allows for the narratives coming out of Wisconsin and out of all parts of this country to be told in a fair and just way. This is where the connection really lives. It's in who controls the stories that we're telling about our most fundamental rights. Is it big companies, or is it a representative government? Is it the people themselves? This is what we're trying. This is the fundamental battle. Who controls our right to work? who controls our right to live, our wages, our basic human rights codified in the American Constitution. This is the question. This is the fundamental question. This is the battle that's been raging for the last 100 years, is the fight between companies and the people. And we need to crystallize that in Wisconsin, the fight around wages, the fight around labor practices, the fight around being able to, the right to organize and the right to unionize, this appears to be a fight between the Republicans and the Democrats. But in all honesty, the role of big corporations in wiping out the union movement, it's no different. The dynamics of it are no different than the big corporations that want to wipe out the media regulations. This drive, this conservative drive to wipe out regulation, to wipe out protections, to wipe out the right to organize, is from the same place. It all comes from the same place. So when we fight for media regulations, we also have to fight for worker protection. These are one and the same, in my opinion.
Our guest, Malkia Cyril. Let's go back to the phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Great. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for all the great work that it sounds like you're doing out in Oakland, California. But I guess you're spot on with what you just said, and it kind of ties into my question of, it sounds like you guys are doing a lot of needed work on issues of net neutrality, and I wondered if you guys are also doing any work, particularly on corporate ownership of media, specifically in television. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, caller. Yeah, media ownership, is that in the Center for Media Justice's purview?
Absolutely. And let me be clear, the only reason that we work on net neutrality and the only reason we work on free speech is as a short-term reform, right, as a way to get to real diverse ownership of our media system, a real public and community ownership of our media system. We understand that net neutrality and these open internet protections are a vehicle. They're a vehicle to ensure that I, as a regular everyday person, could own my own website and as a result be able to reach millions of people if I have the right strategy and the right tactics. So, you know, net neutrality in and of itself is what it is. It's a constitutional, in my opinion, it's a constitutional issue of free speech online. But why do we even have a Bill of Rights in the first place? We have a Bill of Rights to ensure that people are protected from the power, that everyday people are protected from the powerful, that you can't buy, you know, supposedly, this is what it's supposed to be, you can't own your way into more free speech than me. And unfortunately, the rules that we have right now actually don't abide by that principle. They say you can own your way into having more free speech than I do. And that's something that for people of color, for poor people, you know, media ownership being, you know, these monopolies being broken up, these duopolies being broken up, means everything in terms of reducing and lowering the barriers to access, in terms of being able to fight bias on television, you know. And we can talk a bit about television. You know, one of the most significant places, in my opinion, of media bias is on broadcast media, on television. I think that one of the interesting things about the Internet is that, you know, the Internet, you can have television, you can have radio, you can have print. You know, there's a lot of stuff you can do on the Internet that allows for new stories to be told, new ideas to be put forward. But television continues to be, you know, I don't want to mistakenly have people think that just because we have this profoundly incredible, you know, digital system, that people don't watch television, right? And that cable companies aren't something that we need to seriously deal with in terms of their monopoly ownership over television. That continues to be a problem, and at the Center for Media Justice, we're continuing to work on all the issues that have plagued our communities for decades. We just see that right now we have a debate around the Internet, and if we can get a foothold, if we can make the changes that we seek on Internet policy, they actually pave the way and create precedent for change in television and other broadcast rules. So that's what we're seeking, is that kind of change. We want a decentralized ownership. We want to return to community ownership. We want to expand public broadcasting. All of those things remain critically important to our work at the Center for Media Justice.
Let's go back to the phone lines to another caller. Now let's go to line two, Champagne. You're on the air with Malkia Cyril.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm curious about the use of the Internet to protect the Internet. There's one currency, even in the current sorry state of our democracy, that trumps money, and that's votes. And there have been at least a few outstanding examples of the votes counting against the money in Congress. Back in about 1994, the pharmaceutical industry wanted to put the slug on the dietary supplement industry, and it looked like the bill was going to sail through until a portion of the population rose in outrage, and it died and has not been back since. And 6 or 8 years ago, the senior lobby wanted something whose details I've forgotten, done to Medicare. And the Congress didn't want to do it, but they decided they'd do it. And then after it was in, the same people decided they didn't like what was done, and they pressed Congress to undo it. And Congress painfully undid it. A month or so ago, there was an article in The Nation magazine about how people in Britain are using Twitter to organize what apparently are very effective demonstrations against the people who are rich and don't pay very many taxes and are imposing austerity on the rest of the population. And so it's curious to me, if there are so many people, as there are, who are going to be harmed by net neutrality being restricted, then how is it that the population isn't rising up and using the very tools to descend upon Congress with such a rain of outrage that they would back off from what they're trying to do?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you very much, caller. Malkia Cyril?
So if I understand the question is, if net neutrality, the loss of net neutrality is such a threat, how is it that people are using the Internet at such a successful rate to organize around that? Is that?
Well, actually, or maybe that was the first part of the question, but I think it ended up being how come we aren't having more, since very few people benefit by net neutrality and we can use the Internet to organize, like Twitter and stuff, why aren't we being more successful in stopping all the evil things going on?
Well, I think, actually the question is answered by the first part of the question where, the caller said initially, votes trump money. And I would actually push back on that question and say that money buys votes. And so, with the Supreme Court, making the decision that they made, I believe it was last year. I'm not sure if it was last year or the year before, but
it was January of last year, yeah.
Yeah, January of last year, to eliminate the last remaining rules that limited campaign finance spending. I think that what we have here is we have big telecommunications companies being some of the largest contributors to campaigns that exist. Outspending the oil industry, which, that's pretty hard to do, to outspend the oil industry. So, I think that plays an extremely significant role in why Congress, in particular, is so loath to allow net neutrality to stand. Money buys votes, and that is my opinion.
But you know what, Malkia, you could also, I think, you personally and your group, along with other groups who've worked on this issue, and there's been a number of them, including Free Press, I mean, net neutrality only became an issue because people organized around it. If it hadn't been for enormous organizing, this would have never even been known to the public at all.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that we have to go back and say that, the Internet has experienced a few rebirths, in its initial nascent state, it was pretty decentralized. It was not a private commodity in any way, shape, or form, and it was created by, technologists of the people, for the people, all of that. The Internet's been bought up. The Internet's been publicly subsidized for private expansion. and it experienced a rebirth, you know, whatever, 40 years ago. And now we're experiencing a new point of rebirth, you know, and the question is, what kind of internet are we going to, what's going to come out of this pregnancy phase right here? You know, the issue of net neutrality, as you said, Bob, was largely unknown to the public. And part of why it was largely unknown is because it was the standard that we enjoyed for much of this time, you know. It was, you know, basic open access, not necessarily access in terms of build-out, but once you got on, you know, you could do what you needed to do. Now that is changing, and I think that, you know, one of the reasons that it's so hard to organize around net neutrality is because the terms are very technical. The arguments are technocratic. But when it boils down, you know, I found that when you boil it down to this question of there being rules that will interfere with your free speech and with your ability to handle your business online, people are very clear. No, we don't want that. We want a neutral network. We want a network that is discrimination-free. We want a network that protects equal access. People are very clear, but I think the arguments have been made in very technocratic ways that dissuade a large amount of the population from engaging in the conversation. I think that that's changing, though. I think that that's changing as people, as the terms become more popular, as folks begin to, you know, move aside the veil. This is not, you know, just like with TV, it took a while for people to understand, wait, I actually have, there are rules that determine what those colors and images coming out of that box over there, you know, and I have something that I can say about them and that's something I can do about them. That took time. And the same is true for the Internet. And so I think that we're seeing actually a real popularization of the fight around the Internet, just as we've seen over the past 10 years of a popularization around the fight around media in general.
Malkia Cyril, we've only got a couple of minutes left. And I do would love it if you would take a minute or so and just briefly explain how you ended up in media justice. I mean, your background and how you got to where you are today, because it's an extraordinary story.
Is it?
I think so.
I guess when you live it, you don't think that. I mean, you know, I was born to Janet Cyril and Michael D. Hill. Both my mother and my father were Black Panthers. My mom ran the Black Panther newspaper in New York and was the editor of the Black Panther newspaper in New York. She also ran the breakfast program for the Black Panther Party in New York. And so I grew up in the direct aftermath of the FBI's intrusion into that particular organization with a lot of people that I consider to be aunties and uncles going to prison on charges that you know, were trumped up. You know, so I, basically, you know, my initial experience with the U.S. government and with media is that if you can't control the story, it can have very direct and horrible life-changing impacts on your life. You know, so coming out of that, coming out of this experience of extraordinary media bias, reading it and watching and listening to stories about the people that I loved and knew well, that were absolutely untrue, poorly framed. You know, the cooperation at times between certain newspapers and the police, local police forces. I mean, these are things that are not they're not myths. They're not legends. They're simply simple facts. And they've been proven. They've been proven in court. They've been proven in the court of public opinion as well.
Malkia. I must say, I hear the band tuning up in the background. Unfortunately,
they want to clear us out
of the studio. Malkia Cyril from the Center for Media Justice, and you can find out about them at centerformediajustice.org on the Internet. Thank you for joining us today, Malkia.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's great talking with you.
I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Melissa Trentz, my producer, Kyle Kroha, my engineer, and I'll be back in 167 hours, everyone. Have a great week. We'll be right back.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The forecast for East Central Illinois. Today, a high near 42 and partly sunny. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 26. Monday, partly sunny with a high near 48. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 34. Tuesday, mostly cloudy with strong winds and a high near 53. Tuesday night, a strong chance of showers and thunderstorms with a low around 44.